Good morning. What I'd like to do in this presentation is first review a little bit where we are in terms of global patterns of disease and global burden of disease, and then talk a little bit about some of the main strategies that have been employed globally to reduce the burden of disease and give us a little bit of a scorecard on how are we doing and a few reflections on where we may go in the future. So first, the assessment around global health. So I'd like to start with a view on global health with the most basic measurements. Those are death rates. And this diagram shows you on the x-axis the probability of dying between birth and age 5. That's the standard measure of under 5 child mortality, ranging from near zero, about 6 per thousand in countries like Japan, to over 300 per thousand in a place like Niger. And on the y-axis here is adult male mortality, represented here as the probability of death between age 15 and 60. And if you squint at this pattern of countries that shows adult male mortality and child mortality, you can sort of see five groupings of countries around the world. Down on the bottom left is a group of countries with very low levels of child and adult mortality. Another blob moving up of sort of middle-income countries with intermediate levels, and then a long tail, like a comet's tail, up of low-income countries with very high levels of adult and child mortality. And then two unusual groups of countries that stick off that basic relationship. The spike of countries up on the far left, those are the countries of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union with very high levels of adult mortality and quite lowish to medium levels of child mortality. And then the set of countries in the middle towards the top, which are the countries of Eastern and Southern Africa with large HIV epidemics. So around about the new millennium, we have a pattern of child and adult mortality that's quite diverse across countries. We have countries in such as Niger in West Africa with levels of both adult and child mortality that were characteristic of the West in about 1500. So despite huge progress around the world, we have huge heterogeneity in achievement across countries. Now, it's interesting, if you want to go beyond mortality rates, you want to go beyond mortality rates to mortality by cause, or even farther, you want to go and take into account time spent ill to have a coherent view of what are the major health challenges around the world. There's some major problems with this. And going back to the early 1990s, if you went around the different departments of WHO and added up their claims on the number of deaths by cause, you would find out that for every death, there were at least three claims. Or another, put it another way, there were three times as many deaths as actually occurred in the world, simply adding up the claims for TB, malaria, cancer, et cetera. And to address this obvious inconsistency in health information at the global level, the World Health Organization and the World Bank, around about 1992, launched a project called the Global Burden of Disease, which has since produced, or attempted to produce, a coherent overview of what's happening to health around the world. This was then institutionalized at WHO starting in 1998 as part of their routine surveillance and reporting, and I'll speak more about that in a moment. Well, the global burden of disease effort has two components worth noting before giving you some of the data that characterize health around the world. First, was the idea that you needed to have a coherent view of health problems, and that the best way to do that was to use years of healthy life lost. In this case, the particular metric of years of healthy life lost is DALYS, and that is a combination of years of life lost due to premature mortality, as well as years spent with a decrement in functional health status. But the second, perhaps more important component for the global burden of disease was to take a systematic view of reviewing the literature and the unpublished literature around prevalence, incidence, duration, mortality, and cause of death for all major causes of disease, injury, as well as for risk factors. And it's that systematic approach to a very patchy story, given the nature of data systems around the world, that's probably the most important aspect to the global burden of disease effort. So what does it tell us? Well, it tells us that the epidemiological transition, the historic shift from pandemics and epidemics to a pattern of disease characterized by non-communicable diseases and injuries is very far advanced around the world. And one way to see that is on this diagram, which uses WHO epidemiological subregions, where they divide the world into 14 subregions. And on the far left on this diagram, you can see the fraction of the burden of disease due to three main blocks of causes. In red are the infectious maternal nutritional deficiency causes. In green is non-communicable causes, and blue are injuries. And the far left is North America, US and Canada, where the disease profile is heavily dominated by non-communicable diseases and to some extent injuries. And on the far right is Eastern and Southern Africa. The next bar over is West Africa, where the burden profile is still dominated by communicable maternal and nutritional causes. But in between, you can see that there are about 4 billion people across regions of the Middle East, Latin America, South Asia, East Asia, where already the profile of the burden of disease is dominated by non-communicable causes, even though there is still a substantial burden due to infectious and parasitic diseases. So the epidemiological transition is much farther along than at least many people in global health realize, as represented by this diversity across regions. Well, in 2004, So that slide, which did work on my computer, did show that overall distribution, a pie chart for the burden of disease around the world, where about 40% of the burden of disease is infectious and parasitic diseases. About 50% is non-communicable diseases dominated by neuropsychiatric causes, cardiovascular diseases, and cancers. And about 10 to 15% are due to injuries, both unintentional and intentional injuries. This slide gives you the top 15 causes of burden of disease in 2004, which is the most recent assessment as undertaken by WHO and partners. So number one cause of the burden of disease around the world is pneumonia or respiratory infections. Number two is diarrhea. So one and two are the sort of classic killers of poor children in poor countries. Number three, representing how a metric that counts years of healthy life lost and not just mortality incorporates major causes of morbidity, namely unipolar major depression, shows up as the number three cause. Number four is ischemic heart disease. Number five is HIV/AIDS, and that's what's interesting is that HIV/AIDS was as high as number three, but with the revision down by UNAIDS and WHO of the estimates of seroprevalence that we've seen in recent years, it's now number five in terms of global burden of disease. Stroke, six. Prematurity and low birth weight, number seven. Birth asphyxia and birth trauma, number eight. Road traffic accidents, representing an epidemic that we're seeing around the developing world, comes as number nine. Neonatal infections, particularly sepsis, at 10. And then you can see the next five include a number of the conditions you might expect to see in the top 15, nutritional deficiencies, TB, malaria, and then a major non-communicable disease showing up as chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, reflecting the extent of the tobacco epidemic already around the world. Well, it's important to not only look at the burden of disease in terms of diseases and injuries, but another component of the global burden of disease effort is being an effort by many scientists to review the risk factor exposure data, the systematic reviews of relative risks, and put together a picture of the fraction of the burden of disease worldwide due to major risk factors. Here's a slide showing the top 20 risk factors. And each bar is the fraction of the burden of disease attributable to that risk, divided into three components. The harm due to the exposures in low-income countries in yellow, the harm in middle-income countries in blue, and then high-income countries shown, middle-income countries in red and high-income countries in the blue-green color. And you can basically see two types of risk factors. The ones where most of the bar is yellow, and then risk factors where the bars have a three-color banding, with the harm sort of equally distributed across low, middle, and high-income countries. So the risks that are characteristic of poor countries and dominate the burden of disease there are underweight, which is the first on the list, unsafe sexual practices, number two, Skipping down to number 6 is unsafe water, sanitation, and hygiene. Further down is indoor air pollution, a major risk factor for pneumonia in children. And then a series of micronutrient deficiencies, iron deficiency, zinc deficiency, and vitamin A deficiency, make up the other top risks, particularly for the poor. But intermingled are 7 risk factors that have almost equal burden in low, middle, and upper income countries and drive the patterns of non-communicable diseases that we see around the world. High blood pressure as the first of those risks, then tobacco and alcohol. Then we see high cholesterol, high body mass index coming in just between iron deficiency and zinc deficiency, low fruit and vegetable intake, and physical inactivity, making up the rest of those 7 risk factors. So what's quite remarkable is that the absolute burden of a set of risks that many people have historically thought of as attributes of westernization or affluence presently causes about equal harm in low, middle, and upper income countries. Well, any pattern, it seems like pie charts on this computer don't want to show up, which is unfortunate. But any pattern or any description around the burden of disease is important to recognize that what I was just describing reflected endemic diseases that have a pretty constant pattern and show up in the various data sources that feed into the burden of disease analysis. But of course, there is the risk of epidemics. And what this slide is meant to show is an assessment of what might be the mortality if the 1918 to 1920 pandemic flu were to show up again. This was a paper published in The Lancet a couple of years ago, which went back and looked carefully at the vital registration data and cause of death data around 1918 to 1920, and then asked the question, if those patterns happened again, what might be mortality? Enormous variation in the uncertainty around that, but the median estimate was 62 million deaths in a year, which would basically double global mortality in 1 year, given that we have about 60 million deaths a year in the world today. Most of that mortality, however, 96% or more, would be in developing countries. So what's interesting is that we should remember pandemics when thinking about these patterns of global health. We don't know the risk or when the next pandemic would occur, but we do know that most of the harm will occur in low-income countries. Well, looking forward, we have underway a huge collaborative effort to revise these assessments of the burden of disease. This is a collaborative effort that we organize at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, but involves many partners, the World Health Organization, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, the University of Queensland, and 800 or more volunteer disease experts that have joined various expert review groups that are undertaking systematic reviews of incidence, prevalence, mortality, and cause of death, as well as exposure and relative risks for about 220 diseases, for 21 regions of the world, and for about 30 risk factors. We expect this huge collaborative enterprise to be producing new figures for both 1990 and 2005 in about 2 years from now. All right, well, let me move on from the patterns of disease to what are we actually doing about the burden of disease. Oh, one of the pie charts worked. So, well, before talking about how are we doing at reducing the burden of disease? Let me note what I think we all know, but it's good to see our general impressions quantified in real numbers. And that is, there's been a large increase in funding for global health. First, from the national government, taxpayer, and out-of-pocket perspective, what people in countries, both developing and developed, pay. And then second, let me refer to the increase in resources flowing from the north to the south. So globally, in the most recent assessment, which is for 2004, there's about $4 trillion a year spent on health. The U.S. makes up about 45% of the total global spending on healthcare. The European Union makes up a further 30%, other high-income countries a further 1/8, and then the entire developing world, both low-income and middle-income, including China, including India, including Brazil, makes up the remaining about 10% of spending. Of that $400 billion spent in developing countries of their own resources for health, a huge concentration is in the middle income or countries in transition, places like China, Brazil, or Mexico. And if you look at the poorest countries, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, including South Africa, which is not that poor, only about $35 billion spent on health overall. Now, contrast those numbers, $400 billion in the developing world, $35 billion in sub-Saharan Africa, with the growth of aid flows from north to south. And this is an assessment that we haven't published yet from the IHME, which will be coming out towards the end of this year. And this is a careful review of all spending in real terms, adjusted for inflation. So this is real 2006 dollars of development assistance for health. Back in 1990, there was about $3 billion going to global health, a substantial fraction of that in blue, representing the UN agencies. And you can see that there was steady progress to about 2002, where we reached about $8 billion, and then accelerated growth of spending on global health. This era of PEPFAR, the President's Malaria Initiative, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the advent of the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria, Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations, all of those combined with enhanced private giving through philanthropies in the US particularly, means that we're almost have $19 billion a year in 2006. And so far, despite many concerns, particularly enhanced by last month's financial crisis, that this growth will stop, there's no sign of it slowing down in the partial data that we see for 2007 or 2008. So in an era of hugely enhanced flows from north to south, but nevertheless, while those flows are critically important, particularly for sub-Saharan Africa, they're quite small compared to spending in the developing world of their own resources. New monies. What have they achieved? And so what I'd like to do is review the data on the delivery of critical strategies, particularly those embedded in the Millennium Development Goals around the developing world. Now, you would have thought this would be an easy task, that we would have readily available information on the delivery of critical interventions for mothers, for children, for TB, for HIV and malaria, and others. But the data are very sparse. It's quite difficult to analyze them, and you can have quite different interpretations depending on how you go about doing this. So first, reflecting some of our own work at the IHME, where we've done a systematic review of the data from household surveys on the fraction of deliveries taking place with a skilled birth attendant, which, as you may know, is one of the Millennium Development Indicators for MDG 5. And the story there is steady progress from about 40% of births with a skilled birth attendant up to about 55% in the year 2000, and there's been no progress since the year 2000. So despite the huge increase of resources for global health, no progress globally in terms of women having skilled birth attendants at the point of delivery. Pretty concerning, given that many countries' policies on bilateral aid and the global community has put a strong emphasis on maternal health. What about immunization? Another critical strategy. We've had the advent of the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations, a very important initiative that began in the late 1990s and has delivered increased funding for immunization programs around the world. And the challenge here is making sense of the data. And I just give you one slide for one country to point out that this task of understanding, are we making progress, isn't so easy. So on this slide, you can see for Mali, in X's, the official administrative data reports that the government of Mali passes on to WHO and UNICEF. And in blue, purple, and red are household surveys. The blue ones are the demographic and health surveys funded by USAID. And the good news for the blue points, which we put more reliance on because they're population-based assessments, is that there is progress in Mali. Immunization coverage is going up and probably has achieved 75% in Mali. However, the bad news is that immunization as reported by the government, which is close to 100% by Mali, is a substantial exaggeration of true achievement. So when you put that together globally, you find out that global coverage as reported by countries to WHO and UNICEF in red, the WHO UNICEF assessments in blue, and our household survey-based assessments in black, that there has been real steady progress in immunization coverage from about 1985 to 2006, but there has not been any acceleration of progress since 2000. So despite the official numbers telling us that Gavi has increased immunization coverage quite dramatically, that's probably not the case. There's been steady progress, but nowhere near the degree of progress that we have currently believed in the global community. What about for MDG-6? Well, for malaria, the story of enhanced bed net delivery is a story, I think, of remarkable progress in a very short period of time. Here's household survey data showing that a number of countries have gone from essentially zero coverage in the late 1990s to about 30% of children on average sleeping under a bed net. Niger, Ethiopia, Mali, the Gambia and Zambia, and Guinea-Bissau reporting coverage of over 40%. So compared to zero, this is really quite dramatic, steady growth in what was a neglected strategy even up to 2-3 years ago. For tuberculosis, we're all familiar with the DOTS strategy. And the DOTS strategy for a long time did not increase the fraction of TB cases that were being diagnosed. It enhanced the treatment completion rates. But as you can see in the purple dots, the fraction of cases that were being diagnosed stayed constant from early 1990s around about 45% to 50%. And in recent years, there seems to be real progress in the fraction that are being diagnosed and moving up the sort of degree of penetration of DOTS into the community. There are debates about the validity of these data, and I won't go into those, but nevertheless, I think some reason for cautious optimism that we're finally reaching a point where DOTS programs may be making a difference in terms of detecting cases of TB. For ARVs, perhaps the big success story for global health is that the new monies that have gone for HIV programs, there's minimal or slight progress on prevention programs, but dramatic progress on ARV delivery. So we've gone from near zero, even 7-8 years ago, to about 30% of individuals needing antiretrovirals in the developing world receiving them. And what's interesting to note here is there's huge diversity across countries, both in the left panel in Africa, as well as outside of Africa on the right panel. But in terms of male versus female rates of coverage, females the circles, males the blacks, the solid histograms, the coverage and the success that has been achieved has been greater for females than for males. An interesting phenomenon that we've actually seen in most metrics of intervention delivery that entail adherence or presentation for diagnosis. Well, that's a review of what we've achieved. Mixed picture, progress for HIV, TB, and malaria. Not much progress from maternal and child health. I haven't reviewed the data on adult health, which is very poor. Both the data are poor and the evidence of progress, everything from cervical cancer screening, breast cancer screening, to treatment of diabetes, hypertension, and cholesterol, all of which there's really little evidence that we're making global progress. So those taken together, we can ask the question of where do we go from here going forward? Well, I think progress on in reducing the burden of disease looking forward depends on four strategies, and all four of these strategies get a lot of focus in this enhanced community around global health. Certainly, the development and dissemination of new diagnostics, drugs, vaccines, and procedures has been a dominant focus of both the National Institutes of Health, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Wellcome Trust, and other funders. And there is now a substantial pipeline of new drugs, diagnostics, and slightly less substantial for vaccines, but nevertheless a number of new products coming online, which mean that there will be enhanced opportunities for improving health as we go forward. There has been new investments, but in terms of match to need, the $20 or so billion from the North is increasing spending in the developing world in total on average by about 5%. So real progress on delivering the package of new technologies may require substantial increases of investment, both from developing countries themselves and perhaps from the North. The holy grail around doing more with the $400 billion spent in the developing world, plus the aid flows from the North, is of course that when we look at each level of outcome, and each level of spending, there's enormous diversity of achievement. And so that suggests that the way health systems are organized, the way human resources are trained, deployed, rewarded, and recruited, makes a big difference. And there is now, perhaps as you know well, a huge upsurge in interest in global health, in understanding these attributes of health systems, although not a huge clarity as to what works and what does not. And so the evidence base around health systems is weak, but I believe that we will see an explosion of effort that's already underway of trying to understand health system attributes that may allow us to take existing resources and use them more efficiently. The last, and perhaps the aspect of progress around global health that gets the least attention but can be incredibly potent for driving forward progress, is the whole issue around a culture of accountability and a culture of science in decision making. And there, I think the global health community particularly, different than I think the US, where there's been a long-running investment in monitoring and evaluation, there hasn't been such an investment in tracking health problems and what we're doing about them. And in fact, each of these undertakings, the global burden of disease, risk factor assessment, what interventions are being delivered, all require quite elaborate investments in systematic reviews of heterogeneous and patchy data. And I think it's time for a larger investment in monitoring and evaluation of programs. And we believe that that's going to be a key attribute or key driver of enhancing accountability for the huge investments we make in public health and medicine. So, in summary, where are we? We have improved measurement, at least of health outcomes, which tells us that we're making slow progress on health outcomes with clear adverse trends around HIV and adult mortality in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, and a heterogeneous mix or pattern of decline for both child and adult mortality in the rest of the world. We have encouraging progress with new funds and expansion of intervention coverage for HIV, TB, and malaria, but no progress for maternal and child health and for adult interventions. And that although I haven't stressed it in the data that I presented, the evidence on the widening gap between our effectiveness of delivering a package of services for HIV, TB, malaria, and less maternal and child health, and the rest of the public health and medical care agenda, as represented both by the diseases and risk factors that I outlined, is growing. And last, we have this huge new pipeline of technologies coming, but unclear how the existing resources that are available will be used and how health systems can be made more efficient to deliver those to people around the world. So thank you for your attention.